the minimal stuff. And I thought that was better.
Yeah.
Talk show.
Man.
Recorded
Saturday
live.
And then Saturday night, I was horrible sick again. And Sunday, all day Sunday, I couldn't talk.
Yeah, you're not.
Rick, join us. Yeah, no, yesterday I could not talk at all. I could whisper for a little bit. And that's
a little sign language.
Yeah, I actually did resort to writing notes at one point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but that's not what we're here to talk about, right?
Well, I guess we are.
I haven't even looked to see how many questions we have. 4 comments?
Yes, generated by guess who?
I really feel y'all submitted most of them. Well, hey, you know, somebody, you know, I completely believe that if you have that question,
yes,
probably somebody else does too.
Well, I know they do because that's where I got them.
Yeah. Oh, men's brains. I bet that one's interesting.
Okay, so we will begin with men's brains.
My goodness, Rick, where are you?
That's not me, I don't think.
Oh, it's Denny.
Oh, it's me.
So.
It's him.
It's Wendy.
He's probably trying to get from his office building to the car.
Oh. Well, Rick, you can mute him maybe until he stops being blue.
Well, I can't because I'm not on top two.
Yes, you are.
Not anymore.
Oh, well, Denny, do you want to push *6?
I'll try.
Okay, *6 will mute you, and then you can push *6 again, and it'll unmute you.
Oh,
beautiful.
That's great, because before we couldn't get the cell phones to mute. But
yep, *6. One of the 911 marriage participants said that worked on conference calls, and we tried it, and sure enough. So Rick,
yes,
do you want me to read the question, or do you have it in front of you?
I've got it.
Okay.
I'm ready.
I'm gonna mute me so I can cough and sneeze and whatever. Not bother.
Sounds good. So this question, this is a group question. There was much discussion on this in our group. We know that men think differently about sex than women do, and maybe think is not exactly the right word, but one of the women in the group said that her husband told her he wonders how every woman he sees would be, and I guess our question is that typical for men in general? Is it just a guy brain, and are we totally clueless? So the answer to the first question is, according to Archibald's heart, that is actually kind of an acculturation thing that happens to men, because in our particular culture, especially with an addictive mind, you begin to think like that. So that's actually more of a trained behavior. It's interesting. His research, I think, has shown that if men in recovery and begin to look at women very differently as they do that, that the frequency by which they think about it and wonder how every woman is, that actually goes down very, 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 very significantly. So I think that's more of an addictive sort of way of looking at life. And part of that is also a way that I think media, just might want to throw media under the bus necessarily, but at some levels they have, I think, created that scenario. And, you know, it's interesting. I remember in a group a long time ago, I actually thought I was being smart. I was doing what's called challenge cards, and I was trying to help this one gentleman kind of change the way he looked at women. And so because in his mind, and it depends on where someone is actually kind of delayed in terms of developmentally their kind of sexual development and what we call the courtship dance, as to whether they're just noticing what they think the other person is thinking, but they're basically projecting onto that other person. And this particular person, every time he saw a woman, would always think that for whatever reason, you know, she wanted to have sex with him. And so I was trying to assure him that this was not the case. And so I had him actually come up with a multitude of kind of what I would call those challenge cards. And what he would do with the challenge cards is he would write a scenario where he would see a woman, and then he would write, you know, kind of a challenge to the lie that he thought he might be believing. And so since we were doing a group and there were like 10 couples in the group, I thought, well, this would be a great opportunity for him to really see how women think. So he passed the cards around the group. And remember, these were all, primarily this group was men who were sex addicts. And so he read the first card and it said, you know, I'm walking down the concourse, and he was a flight attendant, and I see a very attractive woman. She looks up and smiles at me, and then he writes, she wants to have sex with me. And that's his next thought. And then, you know, he, the woman that was, and the way I was doing the exercise, he had to read the statement, the scenario, and then he had to flip the card over. She would flip the card over, and then he had to be able to state what his challenge thought was. This was his exercise. So she, you know, flipped the card over to make sure he had memorized his response, and it said, you know, stop it, Sam, just because someone smiles at you doesn't mean she wants to have sex with you. And so the next, and it just happened to be two wives in a row, because he had actually passed out these cards to men and women in the group, and he's saying, I'm in the grocery store, you know, we're in the produce section, I'm, you know, trying to pick up some lettuce, I look over to my right, there's an attractive woman, she smiles at me, she wants to have sex with me. And that's the way he always thought. And then he, you know, she flipped the card over and he said, you know, stop it, Sam. You know, sometimes people are just in the produce section to buy vegetables. They're not looking to be with you by any means, and probably not even thinking about you. And so he gave his response. And this woman looked at him and said, I can't believe that you think just because someone smiles at you, you know, they would want to be with you. And she said, that is just absolutely nuts. She said, I'm glad that my husband doesn't think like that. And so she looked at her husband and he just kind of dropped his head down, you know. And every woman in the room is glancing at their husband. All the guys are ducking their heads. And obviously it's not that extreme in every situation, but in our mind, cognitively, we have kind of a, especially sex addicts, because they tend to sexualize things and look at things in a sexual way, will always project onto the other person their fantasy, kind of how they think the other person is. And so it is common, but it's not common of all men. It is common particularly of sex addicts. And I heard once, and Stephanie and my wife and another wife were laughing about this at a program we were at last night. We had a booth up for the Affair Recovery Center. And I just made the comment. I said, well, you know, I hear that women think about their houses about as often, or how clean their house is, you know, about as often as men think about sex. And both of them started laughing and they said, probably more. And so in some ways, if you think about, I mean, I don't know, because that doesn't make sense to me why you would think about your house that much in the state of your kitchen or whatever. Or maybe the state of somebody else's house if you see it. But that's the only thing I've ever heard where people have said there's kind of a little bit of a parallel for some women. They'll think about how clean their house is all the time, and that thought is running through their head in the same way that sometimes the sexual thought is running through the guy's head. Obviously, probably isn't nearly as pleasurable for the woman thinking about her house. I don't know. But to learn to shift that thought, ultimately what the guy has to do is begin to look at women what I would consider in a correct way, in a right way, in a caring way, and see a much larger purpose. The problem with just, you know, thinking that when you're just thinking about what it would be like to be with them, the problem is that there's an objectification of that person. And the last thing you want to do is objectify people, objectify women, objectify anything, especially human beings. And so you want to see them as people, not as objects to be used. So I'll probably beat that question to death. The other thing is that we are told we should not compare ourselves to the affair partner. whether that be a person or porn, that we can't compare and that we can't compete. But that's exactly what the unfaithful spouse did, compared us, and we didn't measure up. During the discussion, each of the women said they had never done that before disclosure discovery, that they had felt good about themselves and the love they thought their husbands had for them. Of course, now self-doubt and comparison are the order of the day. How to offset that? Well, I would beg to differ a little bit. I mean, I'm not sure, obviously you can't speak generally about every situation. There are a lot of people, I'm sure, that are not comparing their affair partner with their mate. In fact, they're not even thinking about their mate at all, because if they were thinking about their mate, they'd begin to feel guilty. So what they've done is they've compartmentalized. And I certainly, you know, my axiom that people always affair down, and I believe that. I see that people have some affairs with some pretty doggone ugly people. If they were doing comparative analysis, there would not be any question as to who won that particular contest. I do think what is at the root of this is what I call the cornea transplant, where if you begin to think that your husband, or you recognize, or you finally understand that your husband may find somebody else attractive, you begin to try to look at women in the same way they look at women. And the cornea transplant is really dangerous because, like you said in here, you really don't want to think that way. And at a certain point, just like a man has to learn to, I think, quit objectifying women, the problem is when women get the cornea transplant, they begin to even objectify women and they objectify themselves. And I find that to be really sad. So I think you're far better off beginning to decide kind of in terms of that, what is my chosen response here? If my natural or reactive response, my reaction is to, you know, just compare other women all the time, you have to decide that that is not what I want. And in the same way the man tries to guard his eyes and his thoughts, the hurt spouse has to begin to try to guard her thoughts in order to protect herself in that situation. And hopefully, you know, over time, well, not hopefully, I know over time that, you know, you can overcome that, and you want to overcome that. The last thing you want to do is be, you know, having to compare every woman that you see to yourself. And like I said, most likely your mate, I don't think, was trying to compare you against the affair partner. I mean, there may be situations, but I think that's really going to be the exception, typically not the rule. Wendy, did you want to say something to that? Did you agree with that, disagree? Just wondering, because you'd written that question.
Well, it was from the Harboring Hope group. And it was just that, well, the one of the spouses had told the wife that that's what he was doing, was, you know, comparing her to, and I guess so that's why the comparison thing was, plus that was what the topic was, well, no, it was part of the chapter. But it seemed to be, it was a group of women who had, you know, really strong, good, positive feelings about their relationship and about who they were in the world and how they looked, and you know, to have that all just kind of, you know, crumble all at once and not have something to replace it with. And, you know, having the other person tell you things that are negative about your, you know, about, well, you know, you were fat and this person wasn't, or this person is brilliant and, you know, you're not so bright, or, you know, there was comparison going on. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
Huh, it looks like you're not, Rick.
We lost Rick.
Who said I'm here? Was that Denny or was that Rick?
That was Denny.
Oh.
Yeah,
okay.
Rick's on.
So Rick is apparently on.
The luckiest to sound like Rick.
Yeah.
Oh, here he comes. He's coming back now. That's good.
That's a good day.
I think we don't have a whole lot of questions today.
Hey,
hey
guys,
Rick.
I'm back.
Hi.
My
phone. Was it something I said?
I don't think so. I think it was my phone rebooting for some reason. So, what did you say, by the way?
I don't remember now. It was just that the women, several of them said, you know, that their spouse had specifically compared them. I mean, that was the thing that they were saying to them, that, you know, that part of the reason why they were with the other person was because, you know, of, you know, okay, you're too fat, or, you know, she's much more brilliant than you are, or whatever. They were actually comparing that person. So what do you do with that?
Yeah, so if they're actually comparing,
mm-hmm.
I guess one of the things, if I were them, I would want to know is, then why do you want to be with me? Or did you decide that maybe I compare better than you thought? I mean, I don't know. Did any of them talk about, or did their mates talk about how they'd handled that?
Well, the thing is that, okay, though, in the one instance, the two are not together right now. I mean, I think I don't know if they're filing for divorce but, you know, are in that mode. And, and in the other case, it's kind of like walking on eggshells at this point in the relationship. So there's not.
I guess my thought on comparison from that perspective is you're always going to be able to find somebody that is more beautiful, is smarter. And if what you're looking for, I mean, the problem for the addict at that point is what they think life is about is finding people ultimately who can make them happy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, that external piece. And to me, it's far more about, can you grow up enough where you can love another person, or can you learn to enjoy yourself with the person you're with? And more than that, what are you comparing? I can guarantee if you give me two people, I can show you comparison-wise some aspect of both of them that are superior to the other one. So it's really just a matter of what they're comparing. And I would still want them to know them. What are the aspects? What made them decide ultimately to come here? Because, I mean, we're going to be able to find people at certain times who can make us laugh more, who are more fun, that's just life. But a mature person is able to make their life. They're not dependent on somebody else to make that happen. And maybe we just learn to care for somebody, you know? If a guy that's 55 and is married for 30 years has an affair with a 25-year-old, and the 25-year-old certainly has some advantages over the 55-year-old. However, I will guarantee you that most women at 55 consider themselves to be a much better lover than when they were at 25. And the reason they're far better is they've got more experience, they're more mature, and they understand things much better. They're far more capable of being intimate. So just because one aspect, you know, your body may not be 25 anymore, what you bring is far superior to what the other person has. So I think you begin to focus on those sorts of things and begin to look at your strengths and quit comparing yourself against aspects that are basically more nature. I mean, the fact is people do affair down. And the reason they affair down is they see an aspect like a good look, but they're not half the person. And whatever. There's other places. There's always going to be places we have the advantage and places we don't. But you don't want to let the comparison begin to be the thing that ultimately defines you.
Okay,
again,
I guess there's another aspect of the particular question I get. I mean, with the group that I'm speaking of, it's, you know, a group of really strong women who had very definite, I mean, they had careers and they had, you know, definite positive, you know, feelings about themselves, a lot of self-worth. And you know, when this happened, it's like that's all gone. And, you know, can you talk about that a little bit, about the process of going through, you know, getting better, kind of?
Well, I mean, it's a choice of ultimately in recovery. I guess I believe there are truths, there are things, aspects about who you are that if you drill down deep enough, you really begin to find one. I mean, there's a lot of positive things. Each of us has been granted a lot of gifts. Our problem is when we get rooted, we tend to move away from, we become eccentric. We get off-center. And instead of being what I would consider God-centered or kind of in my true self, I actually move back into a very immature place that's what I would call the separate self, or the separate I. It's very egocentric, it's eccentric, it's off-centered, and it's all about how everybody sees me, what I am, what I'm not, what other people are, what other people are not. That part of me is very restrictive, and it's constrictive by nature. And I think in recovery, we've got to recognize that it's not about self-improvement. It's about self-removal. It's about giving up my ego and moving into the true self and understanding there's a much bigger sense of self, who I really am, that's way beyond the negative constrictive piece. And so when someone begins to compare me, my natural tendency, if I take up an offense by that, or if I let them and their actions define me, is to go back to a much smaller sense of self, the part of me that my value is determined ultimately by what other people think. Recovery to me is very much about an identity transplant. I move into a much larger sense of self, the true self, the caring self, a loving self. I mean, to me, my spiritual self is very expansive. It's all things are yes, I think, in Christ, for instance. And I believe that I participate. My goal in life is to see things through that other God self. It's about recognizing God in everything. It's about walking with God. It's about participating with God. It's about increasing my conscious awareness of God in all circumstances. So when I have left that centered place, my true self, and where I'm resting, I think, in Christ, and I go back to the eccentric, where I'm now back into the separate I, and now it's all about performance and looks, and it's all critical, and it's all negative in nature. I have to really, to really overcome that, I think, I have to be willing to let go of my ego and accept what I am and accept what I'm not, and because to me, the whole goal of recovery is accepting what I'm not and being okay with that. And the injury, or the nature of the injury that occurs from a betrayal, is it makes us want to go back and live in a system where acceptance or lovability or worthiness, desirability is now based on me being good enough, not about the fact that God is good enough and I'm chosen. So I would say a lot of it is very basic recovery, where we really try to get back out of the eccentric part of that separate I and back centered again into God and who I am in the Lord, not, you know, kind of what I initially began with. And I feel like all of us, whether hurt spouse or unfaithful spouse, ultimately have to go through a whole series of necessary humiliations to finally be willing to let go of the ego and to get to the place that we really need to be, which is why I think that, you know, not that I would ever want anybody to go through what everybody's going through here, but at the same time, it's the most amazing place to be able to do that first step and to see that, you know what, okay, so this is me. And even though I didn't give my permission, and even though, you know, it seems like a strange thing that a nice person like me would be here, you know, I really, you know, this is me. So now what am I going to do about it? And when I can get to acceptance, I just want to quit playing that game about desirability being based on some sort of physical attribute or some sort of intelligence. My desirability isn't based there. Because if it is, then again, everything goes negative and critical. So all day long, I say, okay, I accept it your way, God. I turn my life and my will over to you. You know, on a daily, minute-by-minute basis, I participate with you. And I'm fine in that place. It's only when I begin to think that I've got to be good enough, again, that I've fallen back into the other system, and that's where trouble begins. Does that help a little bit?
That was very helpful.
Okay, because I think that's what you have to do with it. And you want to remember that recovery isn't about self-improvement. Again, it's about the identity transplant. It's about self-removement. So it's really getting back into the right sense of self. Healing. Healing is a big part of recovery, yet to this point, I don't see how the hurt spouse can ever heal from such a devastating blow. There will always be invasive thoughts, the whys that I will never be good enough, etc. Please talk about what healing looks like to hurt self. Actually, that's not true. So I think that's an assumption that people make. The intrusive thoughts go away. The invasive thoughts go away. The whys go away. You know, when we talk about 18 to 24 months, generally, if the intensity and the frequency of those thoughts haven't gone away within that, or they're not seriously decreasing by that length of time, I'm deeply concerned about that person and their recovery. So, in fact, it was interesting. We had the mentor couple that spoke at the EMS 2 weeks ago. Their point exactly was, and she was saying this, that at 3 years, she really did not think about it very often. It wasn't painful when she didn't know. Occasionally something would come up. She would think about it, and she would kind of struggle with it. But she said, you know, the frequency of that happening now was much, much, much less. And so I think that's very true over time, that they go away. So healing, I think that hearts heal. But for the hurt spouse, and you put right here the invasive thoughts and the whys, and I will never be good enough. You know, again, it's about getting to the true self and letting go of our ego, the egocentric self, and moving into the God self. And at that point, the question of whether I'm good, you basically have changed the game. It's no longer, recovery is no longer about being good enough. It's about accepting that I am good enough. So I operate out of something totally different. And so, you know, hopefully if someone continues, I think, to play the same game they played all along, and they don't have that transformation, they don't have the transformative experience that comes from recovery, yeah, they may continue trying to play that game, but I would propose that they probably have never had that conversion experience anyway at that point. This is how they've always lived. And my goal and my hope for people is they're able to experience something far deeper, and so that they can get to a very centered place that's full of, you know, where they're full of grace, and it's about mercy, and it's about calm, and it's very much about acceptance. So, you know, it's the hurt spouse has the same recovery path in some ways that the unfaithful self has. We've all got to be able to say, I'll never be good enough. And I want to get out of this small self, this separate self. And I want to let go of this. It doesn't work. I'm not happy. And I want to move into something much larger and, through surrender, do something very different. And besides that, the intrusive thoughts do go down. So I promise they do. Let's see. One of the things that is so difficult to deal with in recovery, I don't know if it's particularly for spouses of sex addicts or hurt spouses in general, but the constant altering of reality that took place in the relationship. Now that we're in recovery, it's hard for me to judge reality because what I thought was will was not. It's a fairly large hump to get over, or maybe a lump, I don't know. One of many large humps. How do I determine what is real? And that one I think is particularly difficult. So I'm going to stay right with the terminology I've been using, because the false self, or that small self, or the separate self, whatever you want to call that term, that egocentric piece of me, is always constricted by nature. And it is very much about what I am not, what other people are not. It's about fear and guilt and shame. But it is primarily a very negative sense of self. And it's basically fear and shame based. And so and I think it lives, by the way, in its own sense of illusion. Probably some of the reasons, some of this was even, there was an unawareness to begin with. Or maybe not, I don't know, but I can guarantee you that it was always about, judging things. It wasn't about a release or an acceptance or a grace or mercy. And so if you go back to that small self or the false self when you get into recovery, and then it's like you're still dependent on circumstances to make yourself okay. If there's a transformative change and you begin to live about something very different, in other words, if it becomes about being centered and being in Christ, or, praying only for the knowledge of His will in my life and to carry that out, I mean, if your life becomes about something different, then your whole reality actually does change, and what's real to you actually begins to change, and how you even look at your mate begins to change. And so I feel like the best way for someone to reset the meters, so to speak, about what is reality is to actually shift their reality and grow into a much larger God sense of consciousness, their God consciousness, and that alters reality. Now, in terms of being able to determine where your mate is at, I think if you're changing, you and you're not living in fear, your ability, when you're not eccentric, but you're centered, your ability to see your mate through new eyes and to be objective and to be loving and caring, but not needy or desperate, allows you to have a much different perspective of who they are. And when you can begin to gain a new perspective, I think it helps to reset some of those meters. But it goes back to, I think, your own recovery work in terms of what's happening with you spiritually. And your spiritual growth, I think, in many ways, helps recalibrate everything. But it's not dependent on, you're not trying to live dependent or judging your mate all the time, because that's codependency. And you just don't want your mate to be your focus. Like I said, whatever captures your attention ultimately captures you. And I want to love my mate, but I don't want her to be the thing that I have to track all the time, determining if I'm okay or not. Nor do I want to give her the power to determine that. I really would much rather get my okayness from the fact that I know what I'm about, and I'm walking with God every day, and I'm participating with Him every day, and that's my goal. And so from that place, I think I can truly love my mate. But it's really, why would I want to even, I'm much less likely to be offended by her because I'm not in need of her affirmation. My affirmation comes from such a different place that I think I can be far more objective with her. So I hope that you're able to make that sort of transition or transformation to a much more centered place in God. So that does alter reality. And you're right, one more thing I'll say about this. I keep thinking about it. I can talk for hours on it. It radically changes your reality. And And when we're wounded, our focus naturally goes to the pain. And so there has to be almost a, I would call it a transformation of the loss in the long run. I know that I've kind of come to the place that where I believe in my own life that probably the best way to see God is when you've been knocked flat on your back, because you're looking straight up at that point. And hopefully the experiences that, you know, that we begin to find a special meaning and purpose, not that we would ever wish it, not the point, but I really do believe personally that the things that come to my life are from God and they're exactly what I need. And so I don't have to judge them as good or bad. I just accept them. I think when you begin to try to judge reality and you're afraid you're misjudging reality, the other thing I would point out is you're just judging, period. And when I can see everything as being from God to me and that he's doing something, I don't worry as much about being able to fully understand all of it. I just want to somehow be able to see God in it. And that actually grants me a tremendous amount of peace. But the shift in my attitude and my focus, which actually I think begins to reset those meters. First 6 months. What does one do in the first 6 months when emotions run high on the unfaithful spouse is mourning the loss or a potential loss of the affair partner? When the hurt spouse is trying to find her way and cope and is taken over by a flood of emotions and behaves in a way that does not make her feel good afterwards and knows it pushes the unfaithful spouse away, how does one stop the cycle, especially when the unfaithful spouse is not really participating in recovery? Boy, have I seen this one a lot. You know, because when someone, especially if someone has been in more of a limerent, fallen in love sort of situation where they're trying to let go of someone else, you know, I guess to me, first off, if the hurt spouse, both parties, I'm trying to think where I even start this one here, both parties need to be focused on, I think, their own. Their own perspective, their own attitude, their own growth, their own healing. I think we help each other to some extent. But if the hurt spouse is overly focused on trying to walk lightly and not, if they're not being real and they're having to, and they're suppressing their emotions in an attempt to try to protect the other spouse because they're afraid if they're real and the other spouse sees how they are, they'll leave and blah, blah, blah. That is the roots and basis of codependency. Codependency is a one-way relationship where you're the only one who really cares and it feels like the other person doesn't. Now, in those situations, certainly the advantage of being in that type of situation is for the hurt spouse. Or if you're the unfaithful spouse and your mate is incredibly ambivalent about coming back to you and you're afraid that if you say anything wrong, they'll go the other direction. But this happens both directions. Again, I think it's about a God consciousness. And I think you've got to quit trying to control your mate's reactions. I mean, not that I want you to be inconsiderate, but if your focus is still trying to make them happy, and your focus is still trying to keep them there, and you're jumping hoops, it's still performance orientation. It's still eccentric. It's still about the separate I. It's not centered in God. And it's about a system of not having to be good enough again rather than that, I guess, change of identity where you begin to accept that in Christ you are good enough. And like I say, you know, I don't do things to be good. I do things because I recognize that I am good because of what God has done. And I don't do things to try to be a saint. I do things because I am a saint. I don't do things to try to be acceptable. I want my motivation to be I do things because I am acceptable. And that's the big difference. And so if the other person's having a hard time, one thing I would do in my mind about leaving your affair partner is I recognize that they're more than willing to go through that pain for the sake of ultimately getting to be with me, and I need to see that as something that's positive, not something that's ultimately negative. And hopefully they can begin to do that. And I understand if the other person is struggling with getting beyond it, I would suggest that they see themselves as being chosen. I would also suggest that they see how God is working in their mate, even when they're going through that hard time. Because ultimately, they need to shift. I mean, the place of peace for them, if they're just trying to be good, if they're just trying to do penance, if whatever they're trying to do that's really creating that distress for them, at one level, especially in this sort of situation, I suspect they've got a wrong focus at that point, too. And they need to begin to accept that that person in the long run was really never going to make them happy. And hopefully, let's then let go of their ego and move into their God sense of self. And in terms of the unfaithful spouse not really participating in recovery, you know, that's a really tough one. And it depends, you know, in general, if someone isn't that interested in recovery, I think you can give them a period of time. The problem is, you know, if there's no transformation, if there's no drive to do something different, it just seems to me that it's human nature that will tend to fall back into the same holes we crawled out of in the first place. And so that always concerns me for relapse sake. I mean, I just hope people begin to take responsibility and at least explore why they would want to be, you know, considering doing something very different.
Well, Rick, I think in this particular instance that total contact has not been broken off between the person and the affair partner.
Yeah, see, in that situation, I think you can try for a short season to give them an opportunity to break it off, and then you break yourself off. I don't think you maintain that sort of situation because I don't think it's healthy at all.
Well, I think the thing was that she was under the impression it had been broken off and then found evidence that it had not been, and that created a blow up, of course, and you know, so that's where they are in that.
Yeah, that's very, very sad. And you know, honesty is incredibly important, and I can only hope and pray that, you know, at least when I see people in that situation, I just I hope they can, you know, I know they've got to get out of it. They don't have to, but they need to desperately. And there really does come a point where you say, this dog don't hunt. You need to make up your mind. And so at some point, you know, I would say she needs to get out if that's continuing. And she's probably already thought of that, but... As I see situations like that, you know, I will give someone a season, but then it's too damaging, as you can imagine, to the hurt spouse to continue to live in what I would consider a pretty abusive situation. So do you think that answers the question?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, I would
get a lot to take from that, yes.
Yeah, I would not suggest that someone hang around very long. And I just pray that, you know, whoever the unfaithful spouse is, that they begin to understand this isn't about, you know, when I talk to people, I always say, you know, this is not a choice between two people. This is a choice between life and death. This is a choice between your small ego and your true sense of self. And the choice is really, to me, you don't try to continue that comparative analysis. realize and understand that everything you're doing, your best efforts have brought you to this place. And back to the Einstein quote I used, you know, that you can't solve a problem by the same consciousness that created it. And if I can't begin to move into a God consciousness, I won't ever solve this problem, and I'm destined to continue to repeat it. And so the goal to me isn't about trying to choose the two women. The goal for this is just my own personal salvation, my own recovery, my own transformation into who, into something very different, where I begin to live in an entirely different system. And I really do pray for, you know, the knowledge of God's will in my life, and I really do surrender my life, and I really do begin to live for something different other than trying to find this woman or this man or that man to ultimately make me happy. I find a whole another source of happiness, so I'm no longer dependent on things I don't control anymore. So I think that brings us to the end of our questions today. Have there been any more, Aaron, if you're still on there, have there been any more questions posted? I can't get back online to see the questions. That we've lost Aaron.
I'm checking. No, I had to unmute myself. I'm checking. Wendy's question that she posted at about 10 till, what does one do in the first months when emotions run high?
Yeah.
Did you already answer that one?
You answered that one.
Okay. That's it then. Anybody who's online have any fun questions for Rick? I guess not.
Okie dokie, guys.
Rick, you've got 8 minutes to go have lunch before your next session then.
That's what I'll do then. You guys have a great afternoon. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Rick. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye, guys. Bye.